From KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Mark Linus has written a book that challenges some of the conventional wisdom of the environmental movement. He doesn't deny any of the science associated with climate change or the Earth's diminished biodiversity. He thinks those threats are dire and they're real, but he does question the way humans should respond to it all. In his book, Linus proposes a new kind of environmental movement, but he thinks we have to get rid of some sacred cows first. Linus advocates nuclear power, for example, and genetic engineering, and he builds his movement around 9 planetary boundaries. He says if you could understand those boundaries and create limits based on them, you could give humanity what he calls a godlike power to care for creation. Today in the program, Linus will join us to talk about the ideas in his book. It's called The God Species. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. About 10 years ago, the writer and environmentalist Mark Linus threw a pie in the face of a man who had written a book that challenged the conventional wisdom of the environmental movement. Now, Linus himself is bracing for the moment when he may get his own pie in the face. He's written a book that takes on some sacred cows. Linus doesn't deny any of the science associated with climate change. In fact, he says all of these threats are real, but he does question the way humans should respond to it all. Linus is proposing a new kind of environmental movement. He advocates nuclear power, for example, and genetic engineering. And he says you don't have to limit human population or the growth of economies to tackle the problem. Linus builds his movement around 9 planetary boundaries, and he says if you could understand those boundaries and create limits based on them, you could give humanity what he calls a godlike power to care for creation. His book is called The God Species, Saving the Planet in the Age of Humans, and today in the program, Mark Linus is joining us to talk about it. Mark Linus is a contributing editor to a number of British newspapers, among them The Guardian and The Observer. His previous books include 6 Degrees, Our Future on a Hotter Planet, and we should also say he's an advisor to the president of the Maldives. Mark Linus is joining us today from the BBC studios in Oxford, England. And Mark Linus, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hey there, Doug. I'm delighted to be on the show, and thank you very much for inviting me on.
I wanted to begin with one of these central ideas in the book, and it's that you place humans as part of nature, which shouldn't be all that controversial, you know. But you say in the environmental movement, for example, it's sometimes the case where humans are sort of seen as this external force, as opposed to as a part of nature. But this seems an important idea for you, that we are not pushing on nature and not outside of nature. We are nature.
Yes, we are as much a part of this planet as the polar bear or the slime mold, and we have as much right to be here as either. And we are a product of evolutionary forces that have shaped us into the creatures that we are. These evolutionary forces have given us the big brains and the opposable thumbs and enabled us to become so prolific and so successful that we dominate the Earth like no other species has ever done before. I mean, the dinosaurs had nothing on us. They weren't nearly as numerous as us, and they had nothing like the kind of impact that we're having. So, nature as separate from humans is over. Most of the planet now is to some extent affected. In fact, all the planet is to some extent affected by humanity because we've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere, the acidity of the oceans, the color of the sky. I mean, there's no way you can get away from human influence. And that's an important change. But I think it highlights the fact that we are a part of nature and that we've evolved within it. And lots of animals and plants have shared this space with us for millions of years. So it's nothing new in that sense.
But you say in the book it's kind of extraordinary how blissfully unaware we are about this transformation. Why do you figure that is? Is this? It seems like denial on a large scale.
I think it's cultural, actually.
Yeah.
If you look at all the major religions, that they're all very much about us being small and needing to worship something larger and more powerful than ourselves, and also You see this coming out whenever there's a volcano that blows its top. When the tsunamis, there's been two major recent tsunamis, and each time it's been sort of the humanity humbled by the forces of nature. Which isn't really true. These things are blips. I mean, they may be colossal tragedies each in their own right, but they don't make any significant impact on our species in terms of numbers or anything else. So there isn't really anything that can restrain us at the moment, except maybe some kind of really awful pandemic. But even that seems quite unlikely because our scientific powers are such that we could probably deal with any microbe that came our way and posed a real threat.
You talk about how we have to sort of tame ourselves because nature no longer runs the earth, as you say we do. Talk about when this idea first came to you, because there was a particular moment. You write about being in Sweden, and you had been invited to join this group of scientists who were talking about this idea of these planetary boundaries. Something seemed to come to you at that moment, and I wanted you to talk about that, if you would.
It's important to say that this is not original in any way to me. I mean, I've sort of brought it together and popularized it. But the concept of planetary boundaries is belongs to this group of scientists that I was invited to meet with in a small Swedish village called Talberg, which has a nice big lake next to it, and these old wooden hotels, and we all just sat around basically brainstorming. But these scientists are people who are really at the top of their fields. Jim Hansen from NASA, the climate scientist, was there. Paul Crutzen, who's a Nobel Prize winner for chemistry and discovered basically the ozone hole, and so real luminaries in each of the key fields, and they came up with a list which was eventually whittled down to nine different areas. And it was proposed that we could actually put numbers on these and say, right, these are the limits. These are the actual scientifically quantifiable ecological limits. I mean, environmentalists have been talking for a long time about there being limits to growth and the Earth being a limited system. And of course, that's true. But I think this is the first time that science has tried to tackle it and actually assign some kind of numbers to what the limits might be.
As we go along, I want to break down these particular boundaries, talk about them. But before we do that, I want to ask about your approach. You're talking about building a new kind of movement, but to do that, you have to take on the old movement, the one that's in place right now. You write about that many in the green movement have resisted the idea of, for example, playing God, which is sort of a central thesis in the book. You know that it's dangerous to do that. But your thesis is again the reverse. You say, as you alluded to before, we sort of are God in some ways. Let's do play that, and but it's incredibly controversial. This seems like this idea.
Well, I owe the original idea for the title to Stuart Brand, who of course is an American environmentalist, and he said, I think it was back in the 70s, we are as gods and need to get good at it. And so this is the challenge, really, is how we do get good at it and how we make use of the immense power that we've gained at a planetary level for good rather than ill, both for ourselves as a species and for the other species that share this planet with us. And I think there's a lot of resistance to that, certainly but not only from environmentalists. I mean, a lot of the resistance to genetic engineering, for example, was very much about playing God and mixing genes between different species and the kind of power that gave us to create new species. And I think people being very skeptical or very, very worried about where this might lead us. And the same kinds of nervousness about geoengineering, you know, the idea that we should take some kind of active role in managing the climate. But the truth is that we're already doing geoengineering because with all of the CO2 that goes into the atmosphere every single year, we are increasing the temperature of the planet. With every single smokestack, every single car exhaust putting particulates into the atmosphere, that affects the climate in different ways as well. So add us all together, all 7 billion of us, and we're all geoengineers. My argument is that we should try to do that intelligently and in a managed way rather than just in a completely random, unmanaged, and unintelligent way.
As I mentioned in the introduction, there wasn't that long ago that you were anti-nuclear, you were against genetically modified agriculture, but you've talked about how you didn't have a, I think as you put it, a road to Damascus kind of conversion, that there was a kind of gradual realization where you figured that it was time now to sort of take on some of these sacred cows.
Well, for me, it was more about trying to reconcile my environmentalism with the realities of the science. And that wasn't difficult for climate change because, you know, I'm a proper dyed-in-the-wool climate alarmist, as some people might say. And, you know, I've written books about how serious climate change is. But I took great trouble to focus very much on the science. Everything had to be properly referenced. You know, there were hundreds of references in the back to papers in the peer-reviewed literature. And then I sort of got to thinking, well, I'm not really doing this about my opposition to genetic engineering. Let's think about that. And people were pointing out to me that this wasn't consistent. And so when I did, you know, spend a couple of years reading up about it, I realized that actually most of my worries were either sort of urban myths or based on a kind of extreme interpretation of the science, which really doesn't stand up to examination. So my own opposition to genetic engineering made me ideologue as the your average climate change denier, if you see what I mean, in terms of being on an extreme wing of the science. And I didn't find that comfortable, and so I really was forced to change my mind.
And you've said that as soon as you did change your mind about nuclear energy, for example, you figured that would be the end of your reputation as an environmentalist. And in some
yeah,
ways,
it was it, really.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think. Yeah. As a Green, I mean, I actually did a talk in London the other day, and it was subject to a boycott. Believe it or not, I mean, the Green Party wouldn't send anyone, and various other groups. So, it's funny, really. I mean, I was trying to be there and have a debate and be open to criticism and to challenge, but people just didn't want to even come. So, it's very difficult, I think. Because it's quite a tribal thing. I mean, you probably see this with the Occupy movement at the moment, that if you criticize it from outside, then you're basically, you're beyond the pale. You shouldn't do that, even if you're raising valid criticisms and people just close ranks.
So is this that cultural undercurrent again, do you think, from within the movement?
I think people just get quite paranoid, and certain of these things are very totemic issues as well. Certainly that's the case for nuclear power. It's become a symbolic issue much more than it is a real one. I mean, most of the in fact, Stuart Brand sent me an email a couple of days ago coining a new word, radiophobia, for this unnatural and phobic fear of radiation that people have. I mean, ionizing radiation is dangerous in large doses, like lots of other things, but to the extent that we're actually exposed to it through the use of nuclear power, it's of minimal danger. In fact, really none at all. And yet it's been seen by environmentalists as this monumental threat to the Earth, and it's really nothing like that. And so, you know, you just think I've got to try and be realistic about this. If I'm going to be realistic about the real threats to the planet, I need to be realistic about challenging the ones that aren't, and especially if they're potentially quite useful as nuclear power is.
You've been particularly critical of the reaction to the Fukushima nuclear disaster there, and the way the anti-nuclear movement, the green movement, environmentalists have sort of exploited that. I think is not too strong a word, at least the way you say.
No, it's not too strong a word, and exploited it in some ways which I find really quite objectionable. I mean, for example, my friend and colleague here, George Monbiot, who's a well-known environmentalist in this country, did a piece in The Guardian exposing one of the most prominent anti-nuclear campaigners in this country, who was involved with the Green Party for many years, a guy called Chris Busby. And he's been selling pills, basically chalk pills, to the children of Fukushima, supposedly to protect them against radionuclides. I mean, there's not only is there no science underpinning this, but it scares people, it upsets them. It's basically taking advantage of a population which has been traumatized by a horrific event, and very high prices. I mean, they're charging essentially hundreds of dollars for these bottles of pills, and that's really as bad as it gets. You know, we've challenged George Monbiot, and I have challenged the Green Movement to say, look, this is beyond the pale. There's no science. You can't support this kind of alarmism, because it does have real effects. And this is what we've learned from Chernobyl, for example. The science there is clear that it's the fear of radiation and the fear that you're going to get cancer and this. People didn't know in the 80s what the effects were going to be in terms of how much they were irradiated. But people who wake up every morning wondering when the tumors are going to sprout around their body, that they are not healthy people, either in terms of lifestyles or in terms of the actual outcomes. And so People need to have a realistic view of what the dangers are. You know, people in Fukushima, they need to know what their real risks are for living in areas which are contaminated by radioactivity and whether they should move out or not. And you don't want people shouting and using waving placards around and trying to scare the pants off these people in order to serve their own ideological ends. And I am very critical of that.
So I wonder what you want from this book, and we'll talk about exactly what you want, is essentially a conversation. You want to create a movement, but you want a dialogue, a conversation. And I'm wondering what the reaction has been, and if you're a little worried that because you've taken on these sacred cows in such a way that you might defeat the purpose of what you wanted in the first place. Do you worry about that?
Oh, I do worry about that. In fact, my wife's always lecturing me. She's always saying, why don't you a bit nicer and a bit more moderate about what you say, and then you might take people with you rather than just alienating everybody. But I guess that's just the kind of the person I am. But I think things have really moved on. I mean, you can see this with nuclear. I don't know how things are in the US, but in the UK, it's very divided now, which is good because it's opened up the debate. And I think that debate really had to be tackled. And it's very important. I mean, if you believe very strongly that climate change is a real and urgent threat that we have to deal with, then you really have no business opposing the largest scale source of low carbon electricity. And it appalls me to see tens of thousands of young people in Germany opposing nuclear waste transports and basically shutting down the nuclear industry there because they are harming the interests of the planet. They've been misled by older environmentalists who've told them what is basically a fairy story. And we need to move on. And we've got to... So, you know, what I'm trying to do is to put science back into the aspects of environmentalism which I think have lost touch with it. That's certainly not the case for climate change. I think environmentalism has been very close to the science, but it is the case for nuclear and some other fairly key areas.
Mark Linus is with us. He's a writer and environmentalist, author of the book God Species, Saving the Planet in the Age of Humans. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Mark Linus. We're talking about his book, The God Species, Saving the Planet in the Age of Humans. It takes on the threat of global climate change, but from another angle, Linus says you can't address the Earth's dire environmental challenges without limiting humanity's potential. His idea is built around the concept of planetary boundaries to manage societies and governments around these boundaries. His book is called The God Species, Saving the Planet in the Age of Humans. I wanted to ask you about, as we get into these boundaries, I want to ask you about this idea of constraint, because it's one of those sort of practical and philosophical concepts that you deal with in the book. And you say that this idea of placing limits and constraints on humanity has been one of those central ideas of the environmental movement. And this idea of limiting growth is so fundamental to the environmental movement. But you sort of take on this idea that... In some ways, this idea of limiting growth, of constraining human population, for example, which we'll talk about in detail or in particular, is just, not realistic, I suppose.
Well, I think there's two parts to this. One is the question of whether you can actually limit growth and still have an economy which serves people's needs. And the second is whether you need to limit economic growth. And I think the answer to both of those is no, actually. So whilst the planetary boundaries give us a safe operating space, if we take the limitations that they provide seriously, but if we use the technologies that we've got available and new technologies and we evolve economies which are more sustainable and basically recycle all of their materials and use non-fossil energy, then I think economic growth can continue even in a conventionally defined way for the foreseeable future. And I think that's an important move on from some of the sort of gloomier forecasts that environmentalists have often had, that we, you know, that growth is leading us into, you know, down a blind alley where eventually we'll destroy the planet. I don't think that has to happen. And in fact, you can see at the moment how the recession has really knocked back clean energies because there isn't the money there to invest. So growth and sustainable development, I think, go very much hand in hand.
There's this question that comes, and you yourself ask it in the book. You know, why not set a boundary for a permissible number of humans? This idea of population, it comes up all the time. How do you respond to that idea?
I actually find this potentially an abuse of human rights, and I know that's a different issue, and that's a subjective and a political issue, but I don't think anybody, least of all environmentalists, have any business telling people how many children they are to have. That's a fundamental and very personal decision that needs to be made by the potential parents. And I absolutely think that everybody should have access to family planning. That's a different issue altogether. But what's really interesting about the human species is that we are probably the only species that's ever evolved, which is self-limiting in terms of our own fertility. You know, no one else does that, from a bison to a microbe. They all expand their population without limit until the limit is reached of food supply. Actually, what happens with humans is that as our food supplies increase and we basically live in cities and have everything that we need, we've got shelter, we've got food, we've got all of our basic needs covered, then we tend to have less children. And actually, that particular facet of the human species is one which is not celebrated as much as it should be, because that actually gives us the opportunity to be truly sustainable.
You say that there is one way around limiting population, but you have to accept that population control is authoritarian, and you find that just unacceptable. I mean, you write this. You say that no one should be forced to have an unwanted child. But also, no one should be forced not to have a wanted child. That you're, as you said, you're opposed to that sort of gentle moral pressure. And I think in some ways it's not just an argument against for someone's human right to have children, but you say it just it seems like your argument is that's not getting at the essence of the problem. That population, it's an issue to be sure, but it seems to be getting around what might be the actual issue. Is that right?
Well, there are elements of this which I find disturbing, this whole debate about population. One of the things I've really noticed is that those who are most concerned about population tend to be elderly white men, and it's the one environmental issue that they're not directly culpable for. So they really love the idea of limiting population, essentially in developing countries, because those are the main areas where population growth is increasing very rapidly. And you see this in the media whenever there's stories about population. There's pictures of innumerable Indians getting on a train, or lots of black babies in a hospital in Tanzania, or something like that. Mm. And I think we've actually got to be very aware of these subconscious imagery which is used around the population debate, because it's actually telling us something about what we're thinking, and I think that is very important to acknowledge, because people don't tend to think of their own populations as being a problem. They tend to think it's somebody else's problem somewhere far off.
You also say that people who have such a difficulty with the population, they ignore the fact that the biggest driver of human numbers is a better life expectancy.
That's true. Death rates declining rather than birth rates increasing, which have driven population growth over the last few decades. So it's basically improvements in our health systems around the world. And that goes for countries even in sub-Saharan Africa as well. And I think everybody would celebrate that. I don't think even the gloomiest environmentalists would say that that's a bad thing and people should be dying in greater numbers. But you do get vaguely Malthusian, if you know what I mean, when people say, you know, well, we shouldn't really be sending food aid out there because these countries are overpopulated. I mean, I do hear that now when I go and do talks and stuff, and I do find that slightly repellent, really, on a moral level as well as political or anything else.
Well, the other thing that you take on is economic growth. And throughout the book, you use language that speaks, as you put it in the book, approvingly about growth as well as innovation and technology. And you say it seems, so counterintuitive for people who look at this kind of constant and exponential consumption, and they say, look, something has to give. And how can you be saying that growth is good or just realistic? I mean, how do you respond to that? Because you're hearing that all over the place, that we have to suspend capitalism or some of these ideas, if we're going to get a hold of this, you have to deal with consumption and you have to deal with economic growth. How do you respond to that?
I think a lot of these people don't understand basic economics. I mean, there is a curve of diminishing marginal utility where if you have one car, that's a big improvement on having no car at all. Two cars is a smaller improvement. Three cars is probably as many as you need ever. Four cars, five cars, you're jamming up your garage, and actually there's a negative utility. So there comes a point, actually, when markets are saturated for most of these major items. And in fact, that point has been reached in many developed countries. We've already seen peak transport, peak travel in the US and many other countries where people aren't traveling the increased distances that they were. And that's begun to level off and even decline. And in fact, there's been peaks reached in Europe as well in terms of actual total consumption of materials, which is really, really very interesting because growth continued. So this is before the recession. And actually, the total amount of concrete and steel and a bunch of other things was actually in decline for many years. So it does seem as if economic growth can go even as we decline overall in terms of the amount of resources that we're using. And that's a very important insight. And I think it's to do with the change in types of consumerism and possibly a shift towards more electronic consumption, which has actually no material weight whatsoever. So these you know, the new areas of innovation and technology are actually very important in this whole area.
There's that argument that you say you hear people in poorer countries only – they want to be like us. So if we start to consume less, they will emulate us.
And you see, as if they're sort of slavishly following our every move. I mean, that's a little bit self-centered, and it isn't the way things work. And I can tell you that from working in developing countries, people want they want to be well off, and they want to be able to consume what they want. They want to be able to go shopping, all this kind of stuff. But the idea that if we suddenly start living in like a monkish lifestyle and not going to the shops as often, that people in China would suddenly throw up their hands and say, gosh, I don't want as much stuff either, is fanciful, obviously.
Well, I want to ask you about your experience in developing countries. I mean, especially your influence on the government of Maldives. What did that experience teach you? I mean, Maldives, of course, has agreed to go carbon neutral in 10 years. Talk about how that played out and what influence you had, I suppose, on it. But what were you hearing from inside that brought that about?
Well, I was a part of this discussion from the beginning. And what I think struck us all was that this is a country which spends 14% of its GDP on importing fossil fuels. So, you know, the Maldives is basically 300 inhabited islands, 100 of them resorts, 200 of them are local Maldivians, all run separately, essentially. And each island is run by a diesel generator, and that includes the capital, Male, which has about 100,000 people on this tiny little island. So let's switch off the diesel generators, let's move 100% renewable, and we can use the power which is coming down from the sun rather than having to import fossil fuels. So that even on the economic level is a bit of a no-brainer. The question is how you raise the funds to do that, how the government can improve its capacity so it can actually roll out this very major energy transformation, and a whole bunch of other things. And so I was thinking, you know, my thinking had to shift from to a very practical level of how government can work most effectively, where you look for large scale source of finance, what kind of scale you do things, whether you're putting solar panels on the roofs of schools or whether you're doing floating islands, and you know, a whole bunch of other things. And I basically started to think more like an engineer and less like an ideologue, as I've probably spent the last 10 years.
Let's go to the phones. Dennis is with us in Bountiful, Utah. Dennis, welcome.
Hi, great program. I'm on board with your guest on a lot of things. The one thing that I would have an issue with is nuclear, and I'm not against it because of for safety reasons or radiation reasons, but any nuclear that we build isn't going to compete with solar panels and wind turbines of today, but the solar panels and wind turbines of 15 years from now, and it's just not cost competitive. I think we should invest in what will be cost competitive, solar and wind and other alternative energies. And if you could address that.
Mark Linus, what do you think?
That's probably the case in some parts of the world. I'm not proposing any nuclear power stations in the Maldives, for example. That can be more or less 100% solar. And for the southern half of the United States, it's probably a similar issue. Although you The problem of intermittency still hasn't been dealt with for renewables. We don't have any options for grid-scale storage. And this is even a problem in the Maldives, because what do you do at night? And you have to have huge batteries, and they're also very expensive, and put the price up of the entire technology. But, you know, I'm sitting in Northern Europe, and solar photovoltaic, solar PV, is really only effective for 10% of the time. I think I've heard of an 8% capacity factor for most solar PV. And so you're talking about spending billions and billions at the moment on putting up solar panels, which are only working 8% of the time. And I really don't think, you know, it's sort of a fairy story that we can do all this with renewables, in my view, in really densely populated northern industrial civilizations. And nuclear power has the benefit that it's a very dense energy source. You know, you have a very small footprint, just one power station, and you can run entire cities for decades, basically, with very small amounts of fuel and produce no carbon. So I think you've got to be really sure of your ground if you want to rule that out.
Dennis Gletschkoff, thanks very much. Connie is with us in Salt Lake. Connie, welcome.
Hello, Mark Linus. I'm also on board with most of what you say, except for nuclear power. And my question is, how can we justify using the nuclear power option when we haven't figured out what to do with the waste generated both in production and after it's been used?
Oh, hi there. Thank you for that. And I've entirely understand your position. Actually, the waste, I think with waste, you just need to recategorize it and take off the sticker that says waste and put a sticker on there that says fuel, because most of what's categorized as waste is still usable as fuel in the next generation of reactors. And there's enough stuff sitting around stockpiled in the United States, depleted uranium, for example, uranium-238, that can run the entire country for a couple of centuries. Just using stuff that's already been mined. So basically, we can deal with the waste issue by burning it up in new generation fission reactors, and that strikes me as being the most environmentally friendly option, because we've got this stuff now. So let's basically get rid of it and let's generate low carbon power at the same time.
Well, what are you making of the way people are reacting? Just on this program, for example, both of them saying, "Hey, Mark Linus, I'm on board." Except for this nuclear part, or except for this other part, do you figure that there's a way that you can have this conversation, and, you know, negotiate around some of these points?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose I took a decision when I was writing the book to deal with these. I mean, there's two particular issues. One is nuclear, and the other is genetic engineering.
Yeah.
So GM food, particularly. Other things, geoengineering, other bits and pieces are basically negotiable, and people don't have such strong views on them. But nuclear and GMOs are absolutely central, and there's a kind of faith-based position that people have on this. And I did decide to challenge it because I think they're both important technologies which can be used to help us meet the planetary boundaries. I don't think we can meet the climate change boundary without extensive use of nuclear power, and I'm not sure that we can feed the world's population within the planetary boundaries by 2050 without genetically improved seeds, for a whole bunch of different reasons. I've written my previous two books. You would notice if you saw them, I just skated around these issues. I didn't deal with nuclear at all. I basically just stuck to the conventional line because I didn't want to offend anybody. Mm. But I thought this time around I just had to. You know, I had to be more honest with myself and with my readers that I thought these are issues that we did need to deal with, and we really did need to challenge and re-examine them from first principles.
Was that a lesson that you took from Copenhagen, where they came up with, as you describe it, the worst kind of compromise, one that satisfied absolutely nobody?
Well, I mean, I've been going to these climate change meetings for many years, and in fact, I'll be going to Durban in South Africa at the weekend for the one that's just started now,
yeah.
Again representing the Maldives. And so I'm under no illusions about the difficulty of crafting international treaties which bring together 190-something governments in a legally binding framework which actually deals with the problem in a meaningful way. It's an incredibly difficult thing to do. And I highlighted the role of China in particular in Copenhagen, because I was actually fortunate enough to be in the heads of state meeting with President Obama and President Nasheed of the Maldives and about 20 other heads of state in a very closed-door session where most of the agreement was thrashed out. And it was China which was basically saying no. And I wanted I felt I had to tell that story because most of the NGOs, the campaigners, were blaming the usual suspects and saying it's the fault of the US, it's the fault of the Australians, you know, the rich countries, basically. But actually, the poorer countries, as they used to be, are now some of the most powerful voices in the debate. Certainly that's true for China and India as well, to a certain extent. And they need to be subject to just as much, pressure to take the best options themselves. So I think the debate has really, really begun to swing round in those negotiations, and it's what the Chinese decide that'll really determine the outcome for the planet, to be honest, on climate change. And they need to know that the world is watching.
You say that there is a way to sort of map out a deal on the climate, and you say the country that is showing the way is, and it seems ironic, I guess, China. China is sort of showing the way.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to put money on it, I would bet that the Chinese will move before the US, because the US obviously is the second largest emitter, and in terms of historic responsibility, the US is the most culpable for current climate change. But can you imagine that at the day when the Senate votes 2/3 to ratify an internationally agreed climate change treaty? Because I can't, and nor can anyone else all the tens of thousands of people who go to these negotiations. But I think China will be different, because China is becoming the clean technologies workshop of the world, and that includes nuclear as well as wind and as well as solar panels. And of course, they've got this trade war going on at the moment with solar in the US. But that's basically a jockeying for position, and the Chinese will win because they can manufacture very large scale technologies for much less money than anyone else. And so I think China will want to come in on an agreement because they'll be able to sell us the technologies to meet the targets.
Mark Lynas is with us. His book is called The God Species, Saving the Planet in the Age of Humans. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West at KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the writer Mark Lynas. We're talking about his book, The God Species, Saving the Planet in the Age of Humans. So let's talk about some of the particulars in these nine boundaries. Anything we need to know to set this up? I mean, you write about the Earth as a system, you know, the idea that it sort of leans towards balance and self-correction, but we're sort of at this point where a planet may be self-regulating, but it's also dynamic. And what do we need to understand about the Earth as a system that helps us sort of talk about these boundaries?
Gosh, that's a complicated question. I mean, I think the geology is important here, to have a really long-term perspective on the way the planet works. The Earth is a greenhouse planet. The natural temperature without an atmosphere would be minus 20 or so centigrade. Don't ask me what that is in Fahrenheit. And you can see geologically through tens and hundreds of millions of years how the planet's climate has varied, how the temperature's varied. It's been much hotter than today at various points when CO2 levels were high, and it's been colder in the depths of the ice ages when CO2 levels were lower. And greenhouse gases are essentially the thermostat of the planetary system. And that, I think, is very important to understand, that because often people say, well, climate's changed before and, you know, it's changing now, so it's probably natural this time as well. And, you know, that's really a logical fallacy, because the reasons climate's changed before has been largely due to greenhouse gas changes. And we're now raising the levels of greenhouse gases, and therefore the planet's warming. And that's changing the energy balance of the system and changing the way that materials and chemicals circulate through the system. So it's a real epochal scale transformation that we're making. And this is just one planetary boundary area, the climate. But, you know, this is the idea now that we're in a new geological era called the Anthropocene, so named after our species.
We've crossed three of these boundaries only, as you say, so far. Humanity has three of the nine planetary boundaries. Climate change, of course, biodiversity, and I guess it's nitrogen as well.
It is nitrogen, yeah.
And we've steered away from one, which has to be kind of a hopeful sign, that the ozone depletion one. Some aren't yet quantified, but talk about the boundaries themselves, Mark Linus. How you propose to use them? How we govern the way we behave, the way we, you know, policy and those kinds of things by using the boundaries themselves. The idea that you have.
Well, the idea is that if we can understand scientifically the limitations of the planetary system, then we can try and design successful market economies that work within it. And you can see this with climate, and you can see this potentially with biodiversity in some of the other areas. But it's also very challenging. I mean, take water, fresh water, for example. We capture so much water now behind big dams around the planet's river systems that it's destroying freshwater ecology. It's one of the major threats to biodiversity around the world. So what do you do about that? How do you grow crops in the places where you get the most rainfall and where it's most water efficient to do so? You know, you need to factor in prices. So the use of scarce resources needs to be properly priced into them. And that isn't the case in many different places. Water is either subsidized or it's free. It's used very inefficiently. You've got fossil groundwater being pumped up to run agricultural systems, which is inherently unsustainable, and so on and so forth. But the idea that there's a quantified limit to, you know, I think it's 4,000 cubic kilometers per year. That's as much fresh water as humanity should allow itself to use. Otherwise, you're going to get into really destructive situations like with the Aral Sea in Central Asia, which is just probably the worst environmental disaster that's at a regional scale that's been seen for many decades. And that's a water-driven issue. How do you do that? How do you manage these scarce resources in a way which is equitable and which satisfies economic needs? That's the real question.
So the idea is, part of this idea is also acknowledging, it's not about the fact that we don't impose limits. It's about acknowledging the science and creating, again, the idea of a boundary around all of these.
Yeah, I mean, this is very different from, say, the Republican Party. I don't want to be party political, but I can probably say this as a foreigner. The position that a lot of the candidates take on climate science, which is just to deny it. Mm. I don't think that's, you know, that's not intellectually sustainable as well as environmentally sustainable. You can't just pretend, you can't wish it away. So the limits are there and they're real. And we have to work out ways to stay within them, which satisfy our needs as a species and the needs of other species at the same time, and provide the conditions for continued economic growth, and which sustain a population of, 7 billion now, 9 billion by 2050, and probably leveling off at 10 billion or so sometime in the second half of the century. So that's the challenge. And I think actually that the capitalist economic system is probably the best way to do it, because, you know, the price mechanism is at its heart simply a way of rationing resources, scarce resources. Mm. And it actually is because it works itself, you don't need to have a government writing out ration cards, as happened during the war in this country, which decides how much everyone can consume. The market system works itself and through the decisions of billions of people combined. And that's the real magic at the heart of it. And in some ways, the Earth is the same. You couldn't plan and operate the planetary system because it's so fabulously complicated, and all of the different aspects of it are operating autonomously, but they add up to this thing that works. It's quite a marvelous thing. And so we need to remember that there are limitations to what we can plan, and we need to use these kind of inherent dynamic forces in the best possible way.
It's interesting when you're writing about growth, you say there really is not much of an alternative to economic growth. I mean, without growth, you have recession and unemployment and political instability. And
only in this part of the world. I mean, growth. You're probably going to say this, but I mean, growth is non-negotiable in the developing world, and that's where the real growth is happening at the moment. It's China having double-digit economic growth every single year. You know, that means its economy increases by 100% in a decade. And that's huge, huge. And any you could convince any number of well-meaning environmentalist types to reduce slightly the number of trips they take to Walmart. You're not going to make any measurable difference to these issues with that kind of non-growth-centered approach, because it's simply not persuasive to people. Austerity doesn't sell, and you can see this when we do get into a recession situation and unemployment's going up. People forget immediately, completely about environmental issues, and they just because they want to put, food on their plates, they want to be able to pay the mortgage, they want their families to be provided for, and of course those are the first things which matter to people.
So we should be encouraging prosperity. I mean, you argue that as economies grow, they're simply more efficient.
Well, that's undeniable. They're vastly more efficient. The developed countries are much more efficient in terms of how much GDP they produce per unit of carbon dioxide, for example. And they could be much more efficient still. They could be producing GDP for zero carbon dioxide once we can get towards carbon neutrality. But you've got to have resources. If you want, as I say, we should build nuclear power stations, you need billions of dollars of upfront capital financing. The same, by the way, goes for renewables. If you want very large-scale use of offshore wind or even solar, you need billions of upfront capital because you've got to put the stuff in now. And, you know, this is a fairly standard conventional economic challenge. It doesn't need some kind of a revolution and a complete transformation away from capitalism. In fact, that would probably be a disaster. It needs us to design ways where we can get the money into the right places and basically get on with building this stuff.
Are you seeing an awareness among world leaders that's transitioning toward your point of view?
You mean amongst heads of state?
Yes.
Oh, I don't speak to that many of them. I only speak to one.
I don't
know. I mean, you never know with these people what they're thinking. Heads of state are very difficult to figure out because they are subject to, the whims of their populations. So they operate within fairly narrow boundaries themselves. And, at around the time of Copenhagen, climate change was the de rigueur issue in town, and everyone wanted to talk about it and have some role, and people have really backed off, and this is the case with world leaders as well. But you know, the process ticks on. We've got the Rio Plus 20 summit coming up next June, and that'll be again discussions at the planetary level, and in fact the planetary boundaries concept is going to be quite high profile amongst that, because a lot of scientists have been feeding it into the formal process. So these discussions will continue, and they have to continue. They will never be adequately resolved, but hopefully we can keep making progress in the right direction.
Here's another call related to nuclear. Rudy is joining us from Price, Utah. Rudy, welcome.
Thank you, Doug. Thanks for taking my call. We all know the downfall of nuclear energy, so I won't get into that. But if you consider the cost to build a nuclear power plant, and what it costs to operate and to remove the waste, to dispose of it. If that money was to be put into thermal, geothermal, and hydro, wind and solar energy, and also reduce our energy demand with our high-efficiency appliances and light bulbs, for instance, like the LED light bulbs that we have, that is the answer. Not nuclear energy. Thank you.
Mark Lanis, you hear this argument all the time, of course.
Yes, I do, unfortunately. I'm not sure what the objection is to nuclear. Is it purely economic? Because I doubt it on the point of your caller. Is it really that you'd think the money would be better spent, or is there something about nuclear that you don't like? It's a bit like saying because you spend money on health, you can't spend money on education. I mean, we have to make priorities, but I think actually we need to spend money on all of those things, energy efficiency and renewables and nuclear, if we're to deal with climate change. So it isn't really an either-or.
In the boundaries, there's a land use change. You write about urbanization being a good thing for the environment. Do you want to say something about that?
Well, urbanization's good from a strictly environmental point of view because it concentrates the places where people are having the most effect, which is where they live. Yeah. And so you've got people in high-rise buildings living in very, very dense agglomerations rather than spread all over the Earth's surface. And they're consequently much, much more efficient. So people use much less energy. There's much less distance to travel for amenities and so on and so forth. So the fact that humans like to live in cities is another inherently environmentally friendly characteristic of our species. And I think, again, environmentalists tend not to understand this and tend to celebrate the back to the land, the rural, the pastoralist, you know, the subsistence farmers. The environmental outcomes tend to be better when subsistence farming ends and people move to cities, because large amounts of land actually revert to forest. You can see this across Latin America, across some parts of East Asia now, where there's been this urban transition, and that's positive for biodiversity and it's positive for the way that we're using land. So what we really have to focus on doing is to more sustainably intensify the land that we're using. The idea of there being a land use boundary is that we can't afford to expand farming any further. We've used as much land as there is available, really, within the confines of biodiversity and the other planetary boundaries. So we've got to use what we've got much, much more effectively. And unfortunately, organic farming doesn't work in that sense, because it's simply not productive enough. We'd have to use vast areas more land if we're to feed the world's population organically.
Mark Linus, let me ask you this finally. You write about the importance of optimism in the scheme of things. Say something about that finally, if you would.
It's just that optimism is more practical. If I'm advising the president of the Maldives, there's no point in saying, well, I think your country's going to go underwater. You might as well just give up, go and do something else, pretend it's not happening. You know, there's got to be... you've got to have some a more useful suggestion than that, and that's going to tend to be based around some kind of level of optimism about being able to succeed in solving these problems. And I think if we can get away from the denial of the realities of these limits, so the denial about climate change on one side, and also the denial of the potential of technologies like nuclear and on the other side, then we can really get to a much better place. But that does mean that people have to be more open-minded, and that is probably the real challenge.
Mark Linus, he's a writer and environmentalist. His book is called The God Species, Saving the Planet in the Age of Humans. He joined us today from the BBC studios in Oxford, England. Mark Linus, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug. It's been a pleasure. Anytime.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.